Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Mary Roach writes books about science that have a sense of humor. She's written 8 books, including Stiff, about human cadavers, and Bonk, about the science of sex. Roach's latest book is Grunt, the Curious Science of Humans at War. She talks this hour with actor and author Benjamin Bush. He asked Roach about her beginnings as an author, writing press releases for the San Francisco Zoo from a trailer next to the gorilla exhibit. This event was recorded at the Traverse City Opera House in June 2017.
It was a little smelly. But I liked having an office, first of all, in a construction trailer. Was kind of, you know, I'm not the corporate type, so that was kind of nice. And every now and then people would knock on the door and open it and go, "Is this Gorilla World?" Because the signs would all point that way. And I go, "Kind of, not quite." But I actually really loved writing the stories. What I wasn't good at was taking the media calls, because you get the call there was a rumor that the cheetah was sucked dry by fleas, and I got that call. And of course, what you should do as a good public relations person is deny quickly. And I was fascinated. I was like, wait a minute, how much blood per flea? How many fleas would that take? How much blood in a cheetah? Is this actually possible? And I'm getting into it with the reporter, and my boss is like, "What are you doing? Just no, it's not true. It's not true. Deny it." So I didn't last long in public relations.
I can imagine that. And your, of all things, your first book was called Stiff.
Yes.
You went right for a single word slang, based off of what was initially two small pieces for Salon, right?
Yep.
About the explosive nature of a Thanksgiving stomach.
Yes.
Potentially, but they were using cadavers.
They're using cadavers, and you know what? That was a poorly designed study, because if you use a cadaver, I'm probably going way into too much detail here about this, but okay. So if you overeat tremendously, it comes to a point where your stomach stretches to the point where it might burst. You reflexively throw up. You have a reflex to throw up, and that saves your life. And if you're dead, though, you don't have that reflex. So the whole premise of this 1800 study, but I loved it because they sat the cadaver at a table, like poured it in. And I'm like, that's my kind of science. Yeah. So.
When they ask you to donate your body, you really have to think everything through.
All right. You never know where you'll end up.
And you ended up at the body farm.
Yes, I spent some time at the body farm. I'm not donating.
No.
People write to me saying, I read your book and I'd really like to donate myself to the body farm. And nothing else in that book does anybody say, "I'd really like to donate myself to automotive safety or anatomy. I'd like to, you know, help educate medical students."
The gorilla house.
The gorilla house. They're like, "No, I want to go rot in a field in Knoxville, Tennessee." I don't understand that, but I always have to mention that you...
Do you have a number you refer them to?
Yeah, 1-800-SMELLY. They would have to get themselves there. The body farm doesn't pay your transit all the way from out of state, which is very disappointing for these people. Who are these people?
It's a whole other thing to worry about.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
How will I get there when I'm dead?
They did a study on corpses driving. At some point. Combine that with your crash test dummy piece, which also led to Stiff.
Yeah, right.
And you got something. Did you have any out-of-body experiences when you were there? Like, can you imagine yourself in that place? Like,
In the body farm?
This could be me, yeah.
No, but not there, but the first place that I went when I wrote Stiff was this plastic surgery practice lab, basically, where there were 40 heads in, they put them in roasting pans because the head is sort of the same size as a roaster chicken.
And they're delicious.
And yes, yeah. I wouldn't know, but if you say so. They would put them
Spend some time on an island.
They would put them in these bands anyway. So I spent time that, and it was a fascinating afternoon, but then on the plane home, I'm looking around at my fellow passengers and I'm thinking, I know what you'd look like as just a head. That was a little disconcerting to me.
With how much you now know because of all the research you've done, has it ruined the world for you? I mean, do you sit down at the dinner table going, oh, I know what's going to happen with that salad.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I can.
That
I
was
can,
a poor choice with the milk combination
that's
there.
Right. And
I wrote gulp.
Your corn kernels, they're going to go right, all come out the other end. Yeah, I know. I know too much. All of the books. Bonk was a book about people, researchers who study sexual physiology, human.
Right.
And while I was working on it, I read Masters and Johnson, Human Sexual Response, which is very, very detailed, every stage of the human sexual response cycle. And when you were reading that book, you can't help but go, when you're in the act, you're like, oh, this is the part where the earlobes engorge. It's like, because it's fascinating, but it's also very distracting.
It's like the pre-flight checks, you know, earlobes inflating.
Check.
Things are going well.
Ready for blast off.
Yeah. And Stiff led naturally to looking at the afterlife, which is what comes next if you
looking for that.
Are people disappointed that you don't give them the answer? Like after all this research, I'm here to tell you that...
I don't know. Yeah, no. I kind of give my readers credit for knowing that I'm not going to have the answer. You know, that Mary Roach with her BA in psychology is going to come out with the answer of, you know, for all eternity, where, you know, what
We've
happens
been
when
waiting.
We die. I'm still working on it.
No. Now, how did that start? Was it the Duncan, trying to weigh the soul?
Duncan McDougal, yeah, exactly. And also, there was a chapter in Stiff that had to do with early on in the days of anatomy and figuring out what the human body was all about. There was a period of time where the researchers, I'm going to call them scientists, they would look around and didn't know what all the bits and pieces did. And so they'd, you know, take the liver and go like, maybe this is the seat of the soul. I don't know, it's kind of a boss-looking organ, maybe the liver. And then actually it was the Babylonians or someone thought that the liver was the seat of the soul. And then the heart was popular for a long, long time. And then when more was realized about, you know, if you drive a stake through somebody's brain, their personality changes. So they go, this is probably where it's at.
I could see how that would happen. Far more screaming in your day.
So I loved the idea that scientists were trying to use science to figure out the soul, the spirit, which is, you know, it's the stuff of religion and
right.
spirituality, but there were scientists who were plugging away at it, and that was what that book was about.
And it feels like you go after taboos that shouldn't be. They're just the lives
we
live.
I like taboos. I think taboos are interesting in that they're topics that people are they're repelled by and drawn to at the same time. And I like to there's a bit of a rubbernecker appeal to my books, but what I don't want people to pick up the book and just be grossed out. I want them to think, oh, I thought this was going to be really gross, but it's really interesting. And often people look away from things like the alimentary canal, you know, the tube from here to here. It's so interesting. Yeah, okay, it's gross. It's a little gross, particularly from the waist down. But actually, the chewing part was the grossest thing for me. But what I was going to say is that it is so when you dive in there. It's really interesting, and you end up with this respect for these things that you never see, your own organs, these precious things, you never see them, they're in there just doing their job, and they're kind of amazing. So I want to pull people in by that kind of like, ooh, do I dare? But then I want them to go away with some newfound awe for their own being.
These books have horrified me in ways that I never thought I would. I'm surprised by them. Now, it's almost like I have the same response that you do after learning these things.
I'm
I kind of
so
walk
sorry.
Around, I really kind of look at things differently. You know?
You do kind of, yeah.
It's interesting. But really, they're mostly just stories of us, the things we've been trying to figure out forever. And, none's accepted. You know, we're all eventually probably going to have sex at some point. We're going to die. We're going to eat. Mm-hmm. We're going to... be shot into outer space, because we're already there if you're looking at it from a certain perspective.
Right.
You know, and we wonder about afterlives. I want to know how much my soul weighs.
Yeah, well, Duncan overestimated just a little bit, 3/4 of an ounce. I think there was something wrong with his. He put people on. This was like 1907 or so, and he worked at a TB sanitarium. He had sadly a steady supply of dying people, and he thought he knew someone had a big silk scale, a giant scale that was pretty accurate at the time. And he's like, "What if we just put them on the scale and we watch when they die and see if the needle goes down just a little bit?" Which was kind of lovely and, I mean, naive, but yeah. I love that he did it, that he tried to figure it out. And
I'm concerned because, you know, I'm a rocker and we have less soul than jazz.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm concerned I'm not going to have as much of a, you know, footprint when it ends. What seduced you into human sexuality with Bonk?
And this doesn't make sense to me now, but I was reading Film Quarterly. I don't ever read Film Quarterly. I don't have a background in film studies, but I must have been in somebody's living room or something. But there was a reference in there to the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson, and I knew that a colposcopy had to do with it's like a cervical biopsy, and that suggested to me that Masters and Johnson had filmed women from the inside while they were sexually responding. And I remember thinking, God, that's unbelievably creative and awkward. And who were their subjects? How did they get funding? And this was the 50s. And at that moment I thought sex research, that's the next book. It was one of those moments where you just knew reading that one sentence.
Yeah, when you see penis camera, you go, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
That's worth exploring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The artificial coition machine. And I was so disappointed that machine was dismantled, apparently. It doesn't exist anymore. It should be in the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. You cannot see it, try it out.
You can't.
The thing was amazing. It was like variable speed. It was quite sophisticated.
Right.
Yeah. And apparently it went faster than any man could. So there was.
It had a lot of stamina.
It had a lot of stamina. Like, the men in the lab were like, oh.
When the robots come, we're done. So, but tell us a bit about the difficulties of getting access to such a rarefied and secretive group of people doing research. I mean, how do you get to get in the room with live research subjects in sexuality?
Yeah, that was something when I pitched the book, I said, of course, I'll be on the scene with my notepad, my reporter's notebook, I'll be reporting, I'll be right there. And so I'd call up researchers and explain what I wanted to do. And they were like, hell no, you can't. It's so hard to even get anybody to participate. No, you can't be there with a notepad, but you could be a subject. So, yeah. What I wanted, and it was complicated by the fact that what I wanted to be able to write about was the Masters and Johnson thing, which is bringing a couple in, not just, if you're studying arousal or orgasm, you really don't need two people. You one person and a finger is fine.
And an earlobe.
And an earlobe. Or a vibrator, whatever. You send them off and they do their thing. But Masters and Johnson actually brought in couples, and every now and then someone does that study, and I'm like, that's what I want. I need to report on this. And I finally found this guy in London. He was doing an imaging technique, three-dimensional ultrasound movies, and he was it's an ultrasound movie, I know. And so he wanted to do the organs in, you know, sexual congress, and I emailed and I said, so I really love to be there for this historic undertaking, and would that be okay? And he wrote back and he said, well, that would be fine, but we're having difficulty finding brave subjects to volunteer, and so if your organization would like to provide a couple, I'd be happy to arrange it. So my organization called its husband. I wasn't entirely forthcoming. I think I said, so Ed, you know how you said you hadn't been to London in 25 years? I think we should go. I have a project I need to do. We'll go and we'll like stay in a really nice hotel and we'll go to see some plays in the West End. We'll go see Jeremy Irons eating something. He has a big beard right now. And we'll go and we'll maybe go to Stonehenge. We have to have sex in front of a guy in a lab coat. And we'll And my wonderful idiot of a husband went, yeah, okay. And he had, from the beginning with this book, he said, oh, sex research, sign me up. Not realizing what he was getting into. So,
I'll tell you, being nonchalant is dangerous.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yep. So anyway, that was, each book had its own unique challenges.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Stay tuned for more of Benjamin Bush's conversation with Mary Roach.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival, which is held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Benjamin Bush's conversation with science writer Mary Roach.
And I'm interested in the titles because you use single-word slang very often, you know, gulp, bonk, grunt, all the way down the line, except Packing for Mars.
Yeah.
That's three words.
Four syllables, I know.
What happened there?
Failed. We just failed. Everybody, my agent, my publicist, everybody I know tried to come up with a one-word slangy title, and you all will be welcome to shout out anything come up with. It had to suggest that the human, it is a little late.
Yeah.
It was like humans in space. It had to suggest, because it wasn't a rocket book. It was the human experience of, you know, weightlessness and all the weird elements of it, physical, psychological, all that. So what one word? Someone suggested void, which there's a particularly good zero gravity toilet chapter in there, if I do say so myself. So that would have worked, but only if you knew that fact. Otherwise, it was kind of a boring void. Yeah. What would you have called it?
The pressure's on.
I don't know. Nobody could come up with anything.
Space. Spaciness.
Space, yeah. Anyway,
But how did that begin?
What, the book?
The book on the actual study of how to survive in space.
Okay, that started a long, long time ago when I was writing for, I was a contributing editor at Vogue. As you can tell, because I'm so fashionable. I was writing for the health editor at Vogue magazine, and my assignment was osteoporosis. It's not that scintillating as a topic. And I thought, how can I jazz this up a bit? So I called, I know that NASA, because astronauts lose a lot of bone in zero gravity because your skeleton kind of just says, oh, we don't need that anymore. So I was talking with an astronaut who's also an MD, and as tends to happen when I'm on the phone with somebody, we veered off into a tangent, and he told me about this video camera toilet that the astronauts train on, because a zero gravity toilet, you're not sitting down, you're sort of docking. And it's a small hole, and you've got to get the angle of evacuation properly, or you're going to block the air hole, because it's like sitting on a shop vac. It's like, so. It's,
you don't want to get too close to it.
And yes, you don't want to get too close.
Then you really get voided.
Oh, then you get voided. Yeah. So anyway, I remember thinking, I probably can't work this into the Vogue article, but I was like, one day I will write about the video. I will sit on the video toilet at NASA, and by God, I did. I wrote a book around that. I'm like that. Did you ever see
the other side of Gulp?
There's the ad for this faucet, this Kohler faucet. It's so obnoxious. It's this couple comes into an architect, and they have this faucet, and they put it on his desk, and they go, "Build a house around this." So I'm like, video toilet, build a book around this, and it's amazing because it's closed circuit TV. So imagine, if you will, you're sitting there, and the video camera is up in the bowl, facing up, and here's the TV screen next to you showing the view. Ike.
It's like backing up in a Prius.
Yes. Very much so, yes. Beep, 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 beep. Beep, only without the sound effects. Yes, it was an unusual, unique view of something that, you know, you're very familiar with. Kind of like the view of Earth from space, I imagine.
No.
Or something like that.
What's on your packing list for Mars?
On my packing list for Mars, condiments, because the food is bland. Condiments.
I heard the...
Mints.
Condom mints?
Mint condoms. No, condiments. You know what I would bring? It's very uniformly colored and drab. There, you know, and you look out the window, there's no color up there. I'd bring one of those paint Benjamin Moore, you know, the swatch, you know, that you fan out, just to look at color. And if I could, some plants.
That's interesting. Because actually, when you watch all the space movies, it's always like white and black.
Yeah.
It's like no one ever bothers to paint their space stations.
No, they don't. And they forget to bring the Benjamin Moore.
Right.
Yeah, because they're not listening to me.
Yeah. They probably don't have Band-Aids either. I'd be worried about the small things.
The Band-Aids, yeah.
Because you're just floating around all the time.
Yeah, and you know what? I love this fact. When you're sleeping, your hands float up and like wake you up. It's like what I found amazing is that because I got to experience weightlessness on the Vomit Comet, that plane that goes like this, and you're weightless for a while. And it was the most amazing thing in my entire life. It was so cool to be weightless. I couldn't believe astronauts uniformly, like after the second day, they're like, yeah, this weightless stuff is such a pain in the ass. You know, your hand floats up. You can't put anything down. It floats away. I'm like, you're complaining about floating in space. It's awesome. But they get annoyed with it. They want to put something down.
I have explosive snoring issues, so I would blow myself out of the ship if I were you.
Yeah, you know what?
Where's Ben?
If you applied for the astronaut program in Japan, that is one of the considerations. If somebody snores loudly, they are out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they can't get rid of you.
Because they, right.
Keep on stuffing stuff in your mouth.
Yeah.
You were in India writing about the world's most dangerous pepper.
Yes.
And that's how you came around to...
Naturally, that led to a book on military science.
Right.
I was reporting on the ghost pepper, the boot jolokia, which is... there's a lot of arguing about what's the world's hottest pepper, but at the time, they claimed that they were the hottest chili pepper, and there was a brutal chili pepper eating contest that locals would do, and the prize was like $100, and some of them were getting taken away in an ambulance, and they were like emptying... buckets over their heads and drinking milk, powdered milk. It was an insane scene. But somebody, while I was there, said, did you know the Indian military, they weaponized this chili pepper. They made kind of a pepper spray, but it was a bomb with a powder, and it would like to clear a room, to, you know, like clear terrain or disperse a crowd. And I thought, well, I better report on that because that's interesting. And so I went over to the lab where they were doing this work. The Indian Defense Ministry, and they were like an ESP telepathy study that I missed, unfortunately. They were doing a lot of...
You should have thought of that one.
I should have, yes. Yeah, ba-doom boom.
Yeah.
So they were working on a leech repellent. They had the chili pepper. And I thought, wow, military science seems like a little more surprising and esoteric than I thought it might be. And I wasn't interested in writing about guns and bombs and strategy, because that's covered a lot on the Discovery Channel and other places.
Right.
But there's just this whole universe of labs that you never hear about, and that I get excited about that, if I can step into some world that I don't know anything about. So that was how that happened.
And flies. Talk about flies.
Flies are interesting, particularly from a military perspective, because flies are both the enemy and the hero. The enemy, particularly historically, because flies, imagine a big field camp like Civil War or something, where you've got the open pit latrine and the mess tent, nothing's refrigerated, and you got a lot of flies, tons of flies, because also there's dead bodies and there's rotting food. Flies are like, ooh, this is Mecca for them. There are thousands of flies, and they're going from the latrine, open pit, and over to the food and landing there, and thereby inoculating the food with the stuff in the pit latrine, and then it's sitting in the sun. And so the bacteria are multiplying and multiplying, and then you'd get hundreds of very sick, dehydrating, and often dying soldiers. And disease killed far more soldiers back then than bullets or bombs. So the fly, when it was figured out that the fly was, you know, the smoking gun, like that they realized the fly was like, they call it the mechanical vector, because it's simply landing, picking up some bacteria and dumping it in the food. Landing, and so that once that was figured out, they would be, in World War II, there were fly control units. Fly control unit, which I love. And there were fly death quotas. Like every soldier was supposed to kill 50 flies a day. Like with the fly swatter.
What do you do when you're done early?
Yeah.
I guess now I just have to go to war.
Yeah. So the flies, yeah. So flies are just. I got really into house flies. They're fascinating in their own weird way. If humans ate like flies, going to a restaurant would be a really weird thing, because what they do, they find something they want to eat, they regurgitate the digestive enzymes onto the food, kind of make a puddle out of it, and then suck it up. So they digest it outside the body and then suck it up, which is a different way to do it. No judgment.
I mean, if that's what you do.
That's what you do when you're a fly.
It's a free country.
Oh, plus there are these amazing World War II, you know, the posters from World War II, there's those amazing posters. And there's a fly, huge, I must say, enormous fly on its back, and somebody's got a bayonet stabbing at the fly, and it says, "This is the enemy," you know, just like a really sci-fi weird stuff. So
it makes it more exciting for the guys in the trenches, you know, if you actually have to stab them.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like on the poster, it looked so much bigger. I'm like, So flies, I found that whole thing fascinating. The other
which leads to maggots.
Yes, which leads to very, very little adorable flies, maggots,
adorable.
Maggots. So maggots, and this is now we go back to, this is World War I, where there was a field surgeon, William Baer, who noticed over and over when soldiers would come in who had been lying out wounded with big gaping wounds on their limbs. Sometimes they were infested with maggots, which initially you would sort of think, oh, that's horrifying. They're dirty, they'll infect it. And when the maggots were removed, he noticed this pink granulated, fresh, healthy tissue and no infection. And he saw this over and over again, that the wounds that were doing the best were the ones that had maggots. Because what maggots do, as we all know, they prefer dead tissue. They don't eat live tissue, they like dead things. So they performed debridement, which is what you can do it surgically, kind of like remove it all.
Right.
But the maggots do an amazing job because they have these little,
they
little jaws.
They go down to the cell level.
They go down to the cell, down to the cellular level, and they're very thorough. So the maggot, and this is still done today, maggot debridement therapy, maggot therapy, the maggot is an FDA-approved medical device. I kid you not. There's a Medicare reimbursement code.
Medicare reimbursement.
True. For maggots. Anyway.
Since reading that, I kind of wanted to go and go to the ER sometime to say, I need maggots. No, we could sew you up. No, I really prefer maggots.
As you can imagine,
because you need a prescription for them.
You do. You need a prescription.
Someone has to send maggots to your, your doctor.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I know that if anybody needs maggots, I can hook you up. I got the guy.
Yeah. You have to get them quickly because then they're flies after that.
You got to. That's the tough part with with.
We got your mag. Oh.
Oh.
Now you have to kill 50 of them.
Right. With this large bayonet. But the tricky part with maggot therapy, are we going on a little too long about maggots? So the tricky thing is that, like any dressing, the little cage, it's called a cage dressing, because it keeps them in. You don't want them straying and becoming flies in a hospital. No, it's not good. So they have to be changed every like 3-4 days before they want to go away and pupate and become a fly.
Right.
So that means some poor person on the nursing staff has to change the maggots, put the new ones in, the next dose. And that's not fun for some people.
I want to bring it back.
Yeah.
Do you ever get ideas from Snapple Cap? Those little facts that they have? Like this one. This one says that...
This is going to be my next book.
This might be.
Okay.
Antarctica is the largest desert in the world. And you've been there 3 times.
Yeah. Don't you have to have... You don't have to have sand to be a desert?
You know what? Desert island is often misunderstood as just being a sand island. It just means it's deserted.
Yeah. It's a desert island.
It's a desert island.
I want to go
island.
To the desert island.
Yeah.
That's true. Many people make that mistake.
Yeah. I'm always
but
looking
not you.
Looking for Snapple.
Yeah. Well, if you find a
I found out one, you know, babies don't actually tear for 3 months. I just thought our child was dehydrated.
They don't for
no.
3 months?
You learn a lot from Snapple.
Who?
Mary Roach and Snapple caps.
Yeah. Maybe I should just go work for Snapple. It'd be a good book title, Snapple.
One word. You carry a notebook and a recorder, and then you hand transcribe everything, which is...
I type. Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Is that hand transcribe?
Yeah, I guess
because
it,
the
you
hands
use
are,
your hands.
I'm using my hands, okay.
Yeah. You can't do it with maggots. But it's
yes.
it's to refresh your memory of everything that occurred. Because
outsource it. Like a lot, of, this is interesting. A lot of writers now send the MP3 to the Philippines or India, and it's good. Somebody does it, and it's transcribed. No, I still do my own transcribing for 2 reasons. One, it prevents me from over tape recording, because I always have in the back of my head, this is going to be a killer to transcribe. So I try to limit how much I tape record, because I know I have to type it. I remember I've got the sound effects and the way somebody talks, and I need to kind of relive it before I write it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your office must just look like something blew up inside there that was made of paper. I mean, how do you control the voluminous amount of data that you have? How do you sift through it all when you begin to compose a book?
I use a very simple, I've got a filing cabinet with folders. And I'm like, this goes in flies, this goes in maggots. No, I'm, no. It's very...
Don't put them together.
Don't mix them up.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Benjamin Bush's conversation with Mary Roach.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Benjamin Bush's conversation with Mary Roach, whose latest book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War.
You come across so much bizarre material, and sometimes you get to keep samples. You have a sample of stench soup in your closet.
I do,
Concerned about the fact that you know.
I do.
I know it's sealed. But what kind of a party is that going to take for you to go, hey guys, wait here.
When I was reporting it, I did smell stench soup, which was a non-lethal weapon. In other words, it's like the chili pepper bomb. It's to clear a room. Monell Chemical Senses Center was tasked by the military to come up with the most potent, effective room-clearing stench. And it started with U.S. government U.S. government bathroom malodor, which is you can purchase this. It's a standardized stink, which was used for testing latrine deodorants during some World War II, Civil War, I don't know, probably World War II. Anyway.
But why can you still purchase it? There's not a lot of latrine, I gotta test my latrine.
You can test any bathroom deodorant cleansing product using, it's a handy, standardized, horrible
smell.
Stink. Yeah, so they started with that, okay, but the Monell Chemical Senses stink experts, they did something really clever. They added a kind of floral, fruity top note, and the top note is when you take a little sniff, that's what you smell. And because what people tend to do on their first sniff is take a tentative sniff, and they go, oh, that's not bad. And then on the keeper inhale, it's called the keeper inhale. They go, because they think, oh, and that's when it hits them.
Yeah.
So it's a particularly dastardly, well-conceived scent. And it's also a mixture of horrible smells, because a mixture, it's not identifiable, so it makes you nervous. You're like, well, I don't know what that is. It might be dangerous. So that also makes you leave. So stench soup, a lot of thought went into stench soup. Yeah.
The military, it's not the first sniff. That should be like the new poster. It's not the first sniff. But it's such a bizarre, like they just said, here, have an archival sample.
The thing is, I smelled it when I was at Monell. They put it under a fume hood, and they took all the samples are carefully kept there, and they brought it out, and they opened it up for me to smell, and then the researchers like, put it back, put the hood down, because apparently it like gets into the duct system at Monell, and like people evacuate the building.
How many times that place must empty out?
When I was writing the book, I couldn't remember what it smelled like, so I said, will you send me a sample? So they sent me a vial in activated charcoal in a bag, triple bagged.
Vial's
in a box.
A good word.
What?
Vial's a good word
vial.
For it.
Yeah, vial. That is a good word for it, a vial. So I had this little sample, and I knew because she'd sent a couple others, like just butyric acid, which is just run-of-the-mill vomit smell. It's not, or Parmesan cheese, depending on context, good or bad. So I had a problem with that, so I thought, I can't open stench soup. I just can't do it. And so I kept it so long. I thought about taking it to the Republican National Convention.
Were you invited to speak?
No. I would have had to. I don't know how I would have gotten in. But just imagine the press I would have gotten when I was removed from the. Anyway, so, but I had it for so long that finally, like on the book tour, I'm like, all right, I was doing some event, and I thought, I'm going to open it up, and I had all this buildup. Well, the activated charcoal was so effective that it essentially had just absorbed all the stink. It was nothing. There was nothing left. It was such an anticlimax. It was embarrassing. I'm up on stage and then like preparing for this. I was a little nervous that they might have to close the building down or something after I opened it. But
that was a bold idea.
It was bold, yeah. And
we're not going to do that.
Anticlimactic.
Tonight.
No, we have things to throw into the audience though.
We do. I had a vulture vomit at me in close quarters.
They do that.
Yeah, well, I know now.
Yeah,
it was the last thing I thought was going to happen when I.
How did this happen?
It was in an abandoned building in the back of a military base. They bought houses, years, 100 years ago, and just kind of left them there in the woods.
Yeah.
And we were on patrol, and I was like, abandoned house, treasures. And so I went to the upstairs, which was about to collapse, and I found this door, which had been just kind of a sealed little trap, side door, which went into a very little piece of roof, kind of a crawl space. I'm thinking, there's going to be a jar of coins or antique photographs or, the Holy Grail. And so I jimmied it open with my Leatherman tool, and I can't see very well because it's dark in there. I just came from the light, and so I get in there, and there's this large dark shape, and I'm like, okay, specter. And it just made this croak and vomited at me, and I tried to tear my nose off to escape. It was like the worst thing I've ever smelled.
Yeah, you know what? I once went to a lecture called Turkey Vultures, Fact and Fiction. And
Mary Roach, ladies and gentlemen. Never a weekend the same. It's not the first sniff.
Yeah, so And the guy who was giving the lecture, he said, turkey vultures, it's a defense, because it, right. It's really rank and vile, and it's you know, they do that to make you go away, and I imagine it's very effective. But coyotes like to eat. This is fact, not fiction. Coyotes like to eat the turkey vomit, so they will intentionally harass the vulture to make them vomit and then eat it, which I thought was just, and the vulture probably going, oh, I need to rethink this whole vomit thing.
Yeah.
I rarely get to tell that story. So.
Nature's amazing.
Thank you. And the he had brought a vulture, and the name of the vulture was Mr. Friendly.
Yeah. Yeah. He wasn't aggressive. He was just disgusting.
Just disgusting.
Yeah. You must live in a world of near constant revelation and discovery. I mean,
it's a
wonderful way to kind of fall through the world, just an endless curiosity. Your books kind of reanimate that in people reading them. I love them. You get these origins of phrase that suddenly make sense because you must come across so many of them, like, you know, licking your wounds.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we just think of as, you know, kind of a thing, something you say or dog, but actually saliva.
Yeah,
is,
it's a miracle substance.
Yeah, it can't.
Don't get me started.
It neutralize.
Yeah.
In bonk, it's one thing. But with relating to viruses, it makes viruses ineffective. So yeah, you know, everyone
and
talks
it promotes
about
healing. Yeah.
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 Like,
if there was some horrible study where there was some animal that they prevented from, like, the animal could lick, but they disconnected the salivary gland. So without, I know, it's horrible. Erase it. I need the neuralizer. But without the saliva, the wounds healed a lot more slowly.
Huh.
And so, you know, like kissing a child's boo-boo, you know, is something that's actually, apparently, speeds up the healing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Disinfects.
Mono
it's
is the only
stuff.
Thing which gets confusing in this line.
Yeah, mono, yeah, you know. Yeah.
It's like, you know, you have to pick your nose or your eye. That's the most direct access to your system with the least defense. It's not your mouth.
Right, right. Yep. Yeah.
You know.
That's true. Yeah.
Lick the doorknob.
Yeah. If you catch a cold, if you catch a cold from somebody who's drinking something, it's probably because you picked up the bottle and you got the virus particles on your finger and then you picked your nose, which people do way more. Science has shown. Somebody did the data. It's in one of my books. I don't remember which one. But there was somebody watching a lecture hall and counting, you know, like how many times people touch their eye or pick their nose. And anyway, there's more details in the book.
All the books are like this, by the way. Endlessly fascinating. But what convinced you to follow the tragic journey of dinner in Gulp? How did that come out?
Oh, that's one of those books that why didn't I think of doing that sooner? Just
no.
It was such a roachable terrain, the whole tube, you know, from chewing, oral processing is what it's called. And there's people who study oral processing, like intraoral bolus rolling, because what you're doing when you chew, you take this food and you break it down, moisten it, and then put it together into a bolus, which was my favorite word. For a while, I think it should have been a punk rock name.
It definitely should.
Yeah, like bolus.
You combine that with, you know, turkey vulture vomit, and you've got something.
Bolus, opening for Anthrax.
Perfect.
Bolus rolling. I don't know that just that world and the people who study it were like just really deep down into oral processing. That's just so interesting. That's the kind of thing I love. Like finding out that there is such a discipline as oral processing, people who study it for years and years and publish papers and develop things like the tongue camera, which exists. I love that.
Is there a camera for everything at this point? I think you've...
Apparently, yeah. There seems to be at least two parts.
Take note. So much to cover, my God. Do you think, and this is kind of one of those big, big thumpy questions, but do you think that science is suffering like it did when it first started explaining mysteries that our ignorance had relied on gods to solve?
Is it suffering now?
Yeah.
Are we going back there, you mean?
We have a huge anti-intellectual move.
Yes, yes.
Where fake science, science bad.
I'm very...
was it kind of the comfort that we had, like, listen, I don't understand it, And so, good.
Right, right. I'm glad someone does.
If everyone's getting sick, it's because we've angered God. Yeah. And good. You deserve it, every one of you. But then someone came in and said, well, you know, if you take antibiotics, you'll be okay.
Yeah, right. Like, right.
Well, how does God that gave work? Us antibiotics then, you know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, do you feel that movement right now, you're writing almost entirely science-based research stuff?
Yeah, I know it's very strange to me that science would be something that you could just decide, I don't buy that whole science. I mean, science, it's everything. Like, how do you not buy... how is there anti-science? Science is kind of, it's the reason we have the internet, it's the reason we have it's the reason behind anything that is helpful that we have. Why would you be anti-science? I don't know, I'm flummoxed and disheartened.
I think also it's so complicated and it's so filled with terms that make us uncomfortable that I'm glad we have a spokesman who can articulate it for us in these books because, you know, you write it like we're talking about it over dinner.
Yeah, right.
You know, maggots over dinner, things like that. but you know, science is also full of hilarious terms. You must just be laughing all the time, especially doing Grunt in your newest book. I mean, I just remember, you know, a flashlight is a moonbeam. It's not a flashlight. I'm like, who? What? You know, sneakers are go-fasters. Or they're sneakers. No, they're go-fasters. You know, this, not a pen. It's an ink stick.
Yeah.
I just learned all these crazy terms.
An ink stick. And a journalist is a media puke.
Media puke. Or the enemy. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the enemy. Or if they're in a charitable mood, pencil.
Pencil.
There's a lot of really great slang. In intentionally great. But then there are wonderful terms that... Somebody comes up, I can't believe someone comes up with a name for, like when I was packing for Mars, I was talking to the waste management engineers, and they were talking about, you know, the toilet we talked about before, the shop vac. They were talking about how, because you're in zero gravity, sometimes there can be, there's a rear view mirror on the toilet so that you can make sure there's no escapee. Because sometimes and there's also, you also have to be concerned about there's a door, sort of like a sliding door that seals off the toilet when you're done, and you have to time it right, otherwise you may have fecal decapitation. That is a term.
I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want that. Whatever that is.
Yeah. There's also fecal popcorning, and these are terms in a journal paper. A journal paper that a guy at NASA wrote. I'm relatively certain that this terminology was how I ended up on The Daily Show because the description for the show the night I was on was, Chelsea Clinton has an interfaith wedding and Mary Roach discusses fecal decapitation. I think there's like, bring her on so we can write that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great coupling.
It's a great coupling.
Let's talk about briefly about how you interview, because you don't just walk in as the outsider and get the outside information from people who clearly don't know you and certainly aren't often interviewed.
Right. Right.
How do you work that?
Well, I don't really interview people in the sense that I don't come in with a list of questions, because my feeling is that I know so little about what a scientist does that. I need them to let me know what the best questions are, and they need to kind of lead me to what's most interesting. So I it's very much just a conversation, and also I stay for a couple of days.
Right, you double back.
I hang around for a long time because the most interesting material generally comes up on the second day. I don't know, it just does. So I make a real pest of myself. I eat up lots of people's time, and I just hang out and. Because I'm having fun just hanging out with this person and seeing what they do. So don't sit down with a microphone and a list of questions. Because if you need specific factual information, you can always email or call, you know? So.
I don't either. Whatever comes to me.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear some. It's interesting, you know. Grunt comes back kind of to stiff. I mean, you end up in the Dover, Delaware Military Mortuary Affairs Unit, which It's a tough place to be. And I'd love to have you read a section of that, if you'd be so kind.
Sure.
And then maybe a piece that maybe is closer to my experience early on from Camp Pendleton.
Yes, okay.
Which just made me burst out laughing. And I actually held the place with, these are MRE, which are the military meals that you get in little bags. This is the toilet paper, which comes in them. And actually, this is their promotion. It's got
this is a promotional item. And I have had stickers made up say grunt. Yeah. On the toilet paper, and so this is a like 1.5 cent value item that I will be giving away for free when anybody who buys a copy.
In the military, that's $14.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Here it's 1 cent.
Yeah. Yeah. So so we have this special promotional commemorative grunt toilet paper. So do we need context here? Let's see. Okay. Yeah. So I'm at Camp Pendleton here. And I don't think I'd even need any context at all. All right. We set off into the scrub. Camp Pendleton is 200 square miles with 17 miles of California coastline, much of it left wild for practice invasions and amphibious assaults. It's like a national park reserved for the US Marine Corps and a lot of twitchy wildlife. This is parentheses. The grunts are forbidden to shoot the animals, but I'm guessing it happens. I'm guessing this because I recently visited the Camp Pendleton paintball range, and I asked to be shot to see what it feels like. 40 Marines volunteered. The one who did the deed from 70 feet, hitting me precisely where he wanted to, can be heard in the background of a researcher's video going, "That was very satisfying." and then the researcher says, "It's almost like he knows you." Thank you.
That was Mary Roach talking with Benjamin Bush. Mary Roach's latest book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.